You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
All right, so you may be wondering about the party favors under your chairs. That's because we know that not all of you are going to stay up till midnight tonight, right? How many of you will be asleep by 10? Yeah, all right. They're my peeps. And so we are going to do a kind of a mock celebration of the new year at noon, okay? So for those of you who are going to bed before, this will be your chance to celebrate the new year. And for those who are staying up, this is a practice, all right, a rehearsal. So at 11:59, this is where I need your guys' help. I need you to get my attention at 11:59. Wherever I'm at my message, just get my attention. This will mean that you're slightly distracted the whole time, but also slightly more engaged. And then we will do our noon practice. How's that sound? Good. All right. If you need a Bible, raise your hand. Someone will come by and let you borrow one of ours. Now, our family has had a lively time over the holidays. Before Christmas, we spent 5 days in New York City. Such a good time. It was really, really cool. We surprised the girls. They didn't know. And so at night, we sat down and I made them watch Home Alone 2, Lost in New York. And then about halfway through, I said, this is where we're going tomorrow morning. We're flying out. And it was awesome. And when we got to our hotel, I made them watch Night at the Museum. And then I said, this is where we're going tomorrow. We're going to the Museum of Natural History. It was the best. It was so great. We walked around the city, took the subway, even got to attend a service at the same Episcopal church that Alexander Hamilton went to. We saw his gravestone and there. It was a wonderful service. We got back on the 23rd, went to bed around 11, 12. After our late flight, came here for service, lit the Christ candle, the love candle, and then immediately after drove out to Southeast Texas, where Rachel's family are, to spend time with them from the city to the country where most of us got sick. And so it's been a bit of a lively past couple weeks. And I've known for a while now that I was going to be speaking today on New Year's Eve, and it's kind of odd that we're not in the middle of a series right now. That was done intentionally. So I knew I could basically speak about whatever I wanted to. Like, a free for all. Joel, just what do you want to talk about?
Clowns.
Done that already. You can listen to the podcast. It's pretty great. But the idea that I wanted to talk about, that it was just kind of mulling over my mind, it was like the love of God. I really wanted to unpack and hopefully help us take God's expansive and sometimes disturbing love out of the boxes that we put it into. And I was working on that. I had an outline for it, and I was about halfway through. I manuscript all my sermons, so I was about halfway through it. And then Tuesday night, I was laying in bed, and everyone was asleep. It was after midnight, and I could not fall asleep. You guys know those kinds of nights where you just can't turn your brains off, right? And at some point, I began to realize, okay, this isn't just insomnia. Like, I feel like God is trying to talk to me. Yeah, I felt like a pattern in the kind of thoughts that were happening. It's like, God's trying to talk to me here. And I felt like he was challenging my sermon, saying, that's not what I want you to talk about. Not that it's a bad topic, but that it's just not the right time. So I'm going to save that, put a pin in it, and bring that back another day. And I woke up the next morning knowing fully well what I needed to talk about. So I got to work on that. And so this morning is going to be a message that will hopefully set us all out for the new year. So if you want to turn over to Matthew 11. Matthew 11, these are going to be some of the red letters, which means these are our records of the words of Jesus. And here's a pretty well-known passage, but I want to use it as a kind of a launching pad for what I want to talk about this morning. Matthew 11, verse 28, Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy, my burden is light." Now let me say real quickly, that word yoke feels a little awkward to us, but in the ancient world, especially in rabbinic Judaism, rabbis, their set of teachings were often referred to as yokes, like the yoke on an oxen. And so your set of teachings, this message of this rabbi is their yoke. So he's saying, my yoke is easy and burden is light. And if you allow me to bring that teaching maybe into the modern day vernacular via Eugene Peterson's translation, The Message, he says, are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me. Get away with me and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. So this is a message about the unforced rhythms of grace. Living freely, living lightly. Because we live in a world with chronic anxiety, debilitating loneliness. Stress is a societal epidemic. So I know we talked about this before, but since repetition is the best way to learn, I'm going to give a message on self-care. And the irony that I am not feeling well right now and talking about self-care is not lost to me, okay? So if you've been in the gathering long, we do talk about self-care regularly, and we take it very seriously because it is to be, you know, I feel like we're kind of making up for lost time with the church's lack of talking about it. It's a holy responsibility. It goes back to our being made in the image of God, Genesis 1 and 2. It goes back to this idea of this mysterious imago Dei. All of us, our bodies, our minds, we are all of incalculable worth. We see it in the story of Elijah. Maybe you remember his story when he's fleeing from Jezebel, afraid for his life because she's going to kill him. And he finds himself exhausted in a cave, and he's done. He tells God, I want to die. God sends an angel who makes him eat and rest. Why? Because God has more work for him to do. But first, you need to get your strength back. We need to deal with your physical and emotional disturbances. It's the life of Jesus who regularly left the crowds who were clamoring for him to go away to quiet, solitary places to pray. Apparently, this mission that God gave his son included times away from work. Rhythms of grace. Living freely and lightly. In 2014, we actually took a whole summer to talk about this self-care. We called it As You Love Yourself. How many of you were here back then in 2014 when we did that series? All right. Well, this is going to be repetition for you, okay? This series was based on this commandment Jesus said summed up all the law and all the prophets. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. And this is the assumption of the New Testament, friends. We have a holy responsibility to care and to love for ourselves. That's how we measure our ability to love others. Loving other people when we treat ourselves poorly is not a following the commandment at all. It's the golden rule to do unto others as we would have others do unto us. And if we treat ourselves poorly, then that golden rule says we're supposed to treat other people poorly. No, we start with this essential component. We can't skip it. Otherwise, we end up like Elijah, exhausted, defeated in despair, not wanting to take another step. So, in order to do God's will, we need self-care, which happens to also be God's will. So, let's start with a little exercise, some healthy coping. Studies show that laughter is an effective medicine, an antidote to stress and conflict. It brings our minds back to balance, actually brings relaxation into our bodies. It boosts immune systems, releases endorphins, all kinds of awesome stuff. So instead of putting all the pressure on me to be funny, I'm going to put the onus on you. So we're going to do a little exercise, one of my favorite exercises. This is how it goes. All I need you to do when I say it's go is to turn to the people around you and give your best fake laugh. Everyone has to participate, right? No one's too cool for this. All you do is give your best fake laugh, and when your fake laugh transitions into real laughter, just raise your hand and keep laughing. Okay, you guys ready? Ready, set, fake laugh. Okay. That's good. I saw some spouses dueling off, trying to say, this ain't real yet. Now that's caring for our souls right there. You see that? You feel like, whew. Yeah. One of the biggest obstacles to self-care is this. Well, it's still going. I love it. All right. One of the biggest obstacles to self-care is this fundamental idea that for whatever reason, we all believe that self-care is selfish. You guys know that? I mean, you feel it. Like, self-care is selfish. You are just being self-absorbed. All you're thinking is about yourself. Surely, this is all that Jesus said is sinful. But this is a misinterpretation often formed and propagated by legalistic faith traditions. Legalism calls self-care selfish because legalism only focuses on doing, tends to only focus on doing and not on being. Legalism values what the body does, but doesn't really value what the body is. This is the message of heavy religion. I know this personally. I grew up in it. But Jesus said his burden was light, his yoke. His set of spiritual teachings was easy to bear. Legalism, in all of its attempts to be holy, gets it wrong. Self-care isn't selfish. It's actually a holy responsibility, and it's actually hard work, ironically. Now, there is a difference between self-care and self-indulgence. So let me talk about that for a bit. Sitting down in front of the television for a couple of hours to unwind is not going to be as effective as, meditation, painting, maybe doing a little cardio even. Just because we get manis and pedis does not necessarily mean we are practicing self-care. Now, you know that moment where you just feel spent. Right? Maybe we see that in Elijah. He's sitting in the cave. You know that feeling of physical stress, emotional turmoil. Whatever it is, it just feels like you have nothing left to give. That's an important moment because that's a moment we have to decide between self-care and self-indulgence. That's that moment. And here's the primary way we can tell the difference. Regarding your issues of unmet needs, are you facing them or are you running away from them? And that's not an easy black and white issue. I recognize that's a subtle thing to discern. Am I facing the issues or am I running away from them? Self-care are positive activities that in the end address the issue. Right? They contribute to our overall well-being. But self-indulgence usually is a tactic that we use and developed. Often we develop them early on in our life and they work. So we do them over and over again, but they tend to be tactics to escape, numb, or evade the issue. Numbing the pain rather than dealing with the root cause. Now, what I'm saying is it's going to be a little difficult, and for those who don't have practice, you have to have grace on yourselves to discern which category to put things, for example, like manis and pedis. They could go either way, really. Perhaps getting a pedicure is a life-giving activity for you. Truly valuing yourself, honoring that God speaks over you this value as a woman. Or a dude who takes really good care of your feet, you know? That's awesome, too. But sometimes pedicures aren't really life-giving, are they? We see them as a little bonus, like I earned it, I deserve it. Without it, I'd probably be fine, but it's a nice escape from the day and the stresses. Does that make it bad? No, not necessarily. It just means it's not self-care. You guys following me? A lot of self-indulgence could be described as simply self-care in excess. Too much coffee, too much sleep, too much food, too much dieting, too much wine, too much shopping. Self-indulgence is our negative coping mechanisms that not only miss caring for ourselves, but they often make matters worse. Like physical exercise, it cares for our body. We need that. But it can also become obsessive and feed vanity. Anger is a legitimate emotion, a feeling that needs to be expressed, it needs to be processed in order to take care of our emotional lives and our emotional well-being. But when it is suppressed, or when it turns into resentment, or when it is expressed in violent outbursts, that's not self-care, that's making matters worse. Relationships are vital to self-care. We need connection. We need physical touch. That's just biologically how we were wired. But some relationships are toxic. Some are self-destructive. Sometimes it's a fine line between self-care and self-indulgence. And what we see in the Bible is that self-care is actually work. It's in this yoke that Jesus talks about. Jesus pulling away from the clamoring crowds was not the natural thing for most people to do. Most of us, if we have crowds clamoring after us, many of us will feel the pressure of their expectations and just do what they want. Others, it'll be really, really difficult for that not to go to our head and to our egos and to keep feeding that thing. Jesus pulled away. Why? Because it is work. Self-care. It's not necessarily easy, but it does lead to rhythms of grace. It's not easy, but this is the path to living freely and lightly. Self-indulgence, on the other hand, is sometimes neutral, right? Not really contributing to health or unhealth, like watching Netflix for a couple hours, right? I did that the other day. I just watched Netflix for a couple hours. I just need to unwind. But other times, it crosses a line into what the Bible would call sin. So if I'm going to binge on Netflix for a day or two and start letting go of my other responsibilities, there was a line that was crossed. The Greek word for sin is hamartia. Why don't you say that with me? Hamartia. It literally just means missing the mark, like shooting an arrow and not hitting the target. That's what it is. Self-indulgence misses the mark. It doesn't actually help. And sometimes it makes it worse. So I like the metaphor of the dash on a car, like the dashboard that you see in the car. In order to keep our lives balanced and healthy, it's our job to keep our tanks full. So back in 2014, we talked about three ways to kind of look at these tanks. We talked about, get your stuff together. All right, get all your hats on. All right, I got 40 seconds, all right? So make sure you got it all. All right, we have 25 seconds. This is going to be a good time, all right, people? 15 seconds. And then Carson, go ahead and hit that. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. Happy Day! Yeah. Here we go. Yeah, no one knows the words past that point. All right, so that was self-care. A little celebration, a little laughter. A little kissy-kissy with our loved one. Okay. Now we need to get things back on track. Take things serious. So I was talking about tanks. Three areas that we could get better at. and focus on. And we always talked about this in terms of body, being, and connections. So body, that would include physical aspects of self-care, the kinds of food we eat. Diet's really important. The proportions of food we eat. Do we get enough exercise? Do we get enough sleep? Do you rest when you're sick, or do you try to muscle through? Irony, irony. Okay. Being. This includes emotional and mental aspects of self-care. Inner life. Our levels of stress, our feelings of anger, joy, sadness, fear, disgust. Pixar reference. Did you guys catch it? All right, good. And then, do you practice meditation? Do you journal your thoughts? These are things that care for your inner life. Connections. This includes social and relational aspects of self-care, our families, our friends. How connected are you? Do you ask for help when you need it? Do you let others help you? On a scale of 1 to 10, how deep are your friendships? Do you allow yourself to be vulnerable with anyone? Connections. Like, there are three distinct areas of self-care, body, being, and connections. But some of you may be asking, okay, what about spiritual self-care? Because that's all I heard about growing up in church. Isn't that the whole point of being a Christian? The message I got growing up was self-care meant I read my Bible and I pray. Basically, just do those and you're good. How many got a message similar to that? You know, you read your Bible and you pray, just do those and you're good. And you're good. And I did those, guys. And it didn't lead to good all the time. And it isn't to say those things were wrong or bad. They just weren't the whole picture. They just weren't the whole picture. So as your pastor, I certainly believe that the spiritual aspect of self-care is vital. However, I would push against the bifurcation that we use to put all these things into little categories. When God looks at us, he doesn't see compartments. Like, there's the physical Joel, there's the psychological Joel, there's the social Joel, and this big compartment, that's the spiritual Joel, because that's obviously the most important. No, God doesn't look at us like Tupperware containers. All these aspects are tied together in one holistic person: physical, spiritual, relational, emotional, etc. So we like to look at it like this. The spiritual life intersects with all of them. Body, when it comes to our bodies, we are taught that our bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit. That's Paul saying that. They are gifts from God. We honor them by the way that we treat them. Being, when it comes to our inner life, our being, we are taught, by Paul, that not to transform but to the patterns of this world, but to be not to conform to the patterns of this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And Paul's talking about that, the idea that holistic inner life, our psyche. Connections. When it comes to our connections, we clearly see how God works through relationships. His Spirit doesn't just communicate to us as individuals, but he communicates us through community. Sometimes we don't truly understand God's love and grace until he expresses its healing power through another person. Vital to spirituality. So around here, we want to encourage a holistic approach that tries to balance out our understanding of self-care. If you're only exercising and eating right, but neglecting your being and your connections, then there's a lack of balance. Our tank may be full in one area, but just dangerously low in another. So imagine you have a dashboard that has these, you know, the body, the being, and the connections. These multiple gauges that help you see how full each of these tanks are. Like any good gauge, when it gets low, there tends to be a little light that goes off. We would call that an indicator. And to illustrate how this works in a general sense, I'm going to bring a concept that I talked about several years ago in that series that is often used in recovery therapy. So this is a teaching tool for people who are recovering from various forms of addictions called Recovery Hill. And so we have the sloping line called Recovery Hill. The top is prevention. When your tank is full and you're practicing self-care, the addict is strong and can resist temptation to give in to their addiction. This is where the addict is living in sober self-care. Sobriety may be from alcohol, from eating disorder, from sexual indulgence, from violence or substance abuse of any kind. Up here at the top of the hill, self-care has filled our tank. All our needs are being attended to, our body's needs, our being's needs, our connection's needs, and our spiritual needs. There's a vibrant connection with their higher power. But we don't live in a vacuum, do we? At some point, stress will come, maybe in the form of a bill collector or vindictive boyfriend or girlfriend, or maybe a traffic jam is all it takes to bring the stress. And when that happens, we encounter stress that triggers anger or depression or loneliness or anxiety. And it's in that moment that we have to make the decision between self-care and self-indulgence. If we have our wits about us, we look at our gauges and diagnose what our legitimate needs are, and that helps us stay there. But as someone who has personally struggled with addiction, I've heard it said that when our inner addict shows up, when we have this compulsion to reach out for our own personal security blanket, that is an indication that we have this unmet need. But what happens if we don't address the need? Then we start to slide down the hill towards relapse. At some point, the addict passes the point of no return, and their brain literally has been trained to act out. Literally has been trained. Addicts of all sorts talk about this moment as if they turn into a robot and someone else takes over their will. You can't stop it. It's survival mode. It's what's sometimes called the lizard or the bird brain, because it's that part back there past the prefrontal cortex where reasoning resides. It's just instinct. One counselor told me the story of a man who's struggling with an addiction to heroin. So he started to walk him through a ritual, because usually we all have these rituals that often lead up to whatever the behavior we're struggling with. And so he's asking this man, what are you doing right before you use? Well, I'm walking around the house, locking the doors and making sure there's no one else there. Well, could you stop right then? He's like, no, there's no way. I know there are drugs in the house and I'm going to use them. Okay, what are you doing before that? Well, I'm kind of like at my dealer's house. I'm getting the drugs. And he says, well, could you stop then? He says, no, man, I've committed. Like, I am doing this thing. Okay, what are you doing before that? He says, well, I'm driving to my dealer's house. Could you stop then? He says, maybe. Maybe I could. So that was what they determined to be the last exit ramp before he gave in. So he needed something drastic to stop this, like, literal neurological pathway that has been buried into his brain over the years. He had to do something drastic to stop that. And so what he came up with was he would pull over and do a Chinese fire drill. Yeah, he would pull over, get out of his car, start running around his car until he called his sponsor. And that's really cool, this idea that went through, but that's not enough, guys. Because you can't just stop the behavior, you have to replace it with a good one. All right, we can't just focus on the don'ts, we have to focus on the do's. And after that, he needs to soothe himself because he's not in a good place. Soothe himself in positive ways. The self-soothing is at the heart of self-care. So just quick question, how many of you are over the age of 19? Oh, most of you, cool. Then that means you're no longer a teenager. Adolescence is behind you. You are an adult. Therefore, it is your job to soothe yourself when you are troubled. It is not your parents' job anymore. We are not children who legitimately need mind games and magic kisses. It is not our friend's job. We can't delegate the responsibility to someone else. They can't get into our heads. They don't know fully what we need. We're not as easily readable as a two-year-old. And it is not our spouse's job. You know what I've never heard in the wedding ceremony? Do you accept this person to be your mommy or your daddy? That just doesn't happen. We must learn how to soothe ourselves. It's a holy responsibility. So once the addict soothes himself, That will buy him time to diagnose the unmet needs that he or she is dealing with. Is he tired? Get some sleep. Hungry? Get some food. Eat some food. Lonely? Call someone. Connect with someone. Meet with them. Be face to face. Stressed out? Meditate some. Calm down. Breathe. I know that sounds super like simple, but that is how healthy soothing looks like. That's what it looks like. And I realize many of you are not like me, that most of you have never struggled with a quote-unquote technical addiction. That's awesome. I really wish I were you instead. However, I would argue that the principles of Recovery Hill apply to everyone. I think they apply to everyone. When it comes to the decision between self-care and self-indulgence, the only difference may be the hill's not as steep. For example, maybe your acting out is withdrawing. Stress triggers you, you get sensitive and easily offended. Instead of choosing connection and self-care, you disconnect and withdraw. And everyone around knows it. They see it. Friends will say, well, there he goes again. There she goes again. Don't try and talk to them. It's no use. Give them a day or two and they'll stop pouting. This is why self-care matters. When we don't care for ourselves, we will be more vulnerable to self-indulgence, which doesn't always look like a six-pack of beer or a gallon of ice cream. Self-indulgence can look like all kinds of things. Sometimes it looks like self-pity and just playing the victim. And this will limit our ability to care for others. If I'm wallowing in self-pity, I'm not going to be very useful in helping others, loving others. This is why Jesus said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. We cannot give out of empty tanks. So when our tanks get low, we must learn to read the indicators. This is the primary task of self-care and living freely and lightly. Rhythms of grace. We have to pay attention to the indicators. If you're feeling lethargic, check that body gauge. If you're feeling emotional disturbances, check that being gauge. If you're feeling like shallow and unknown, check the connections gauge. Several years ago, this was probably like 5 years ago, I was invited to give the invocation at City Council, which is, so all our City Council men and women, they have usually a local minister come and give the invocation before their council. And so this is something Rachel had done like a month or two before, and then this was my first time to do it. I've done it several times since, but that first time I felt like, man, this is kind of a great honor. So I put on a coat, put on a tie. That's not something I do a lot. And I only had a couple minutes, like literally just, you have a minute to pray, Pastor Joel. And I was like, well, okay. But I still sat down and I prayed about it. Like, God, is there something that you want me to say specifically? And I really thought through that and prayed through that. How do I want to say a prayer for our city and our city council people? Rachel and I drove over there. And if you've never been to City Hall, if you have to go through some levels of security. We definitely had to go through a couple extra ones. I talked with the assistant for the mayor. Apparently, the mayor was out of town, and so it was the mayor pro tem that would be leading the city council. But the assistant walked through the agenda with me, said, all right, here's what the mayor pro tem is going to do. The mayor pro tem is going to introduce you. He's going to read your bio for everyone and then invite you to give the invocation. It'll happen at this point in time. And so I was like, okay, I'm ready. All right, there's all this kind of stuff that I had to remember. Well, we went in there in this kind of the horseshoe of the plush chairs. We're sitting down. There was this wooden rail over to the side where all the people were ready to air their grievances to the city. There were cameras. This was being broadcast. There was a bit of pomp and circumstance to it. And as the moment came, I could feel it. The mayor pro tem began to speak. One of the security guards who was standing near me kind of looked over at me and kind of nodded meaningfully, like, "Get ready. Here's your turn." And then things just kind of went sideways. The mayor pro tem, apparently, even though he had been briefed about the whole agenda, had it laying, my bio laying right in front of him, just kind of turned to a colleague and said, "Hey, do you want to open in prayer?" And I was like, "Huh?" And that councilman was like, "Okay," and prayed. And before I knew it, we were standing up. I stood up. We did the Pledge of Allegiance. I did the Pledge of Allegiance. And then I left. And I had several emotions going on. I was angry and I was frustrated. I was confused. I felt hurt. And I felt embarrassed that I felt hurt. I was feeling shamey. Is that an okay word to use? I was feeling shamey. I told Rachel what I was feeling and didn't know why. She said, well, yeah, of course you feel that way. It makes sense. They forgot you. I was like, yeah, they forgot me. They sent me the invitation. They asked me to come here. They prepared me, and then they forgot me. And I know it was an accident that anyone could make, even myself. But that didn't stop it from feeling disrespectful. You know what I mean? I know in my head what was happening, but here I was just like, man, I feel disrespected. The indicator light on my being was going boop, boop. So I had this choice to make. I could go down the path of self-indulgence. I could have engaged in something that I'm quite good at, which are anger fantasies. Do you guys have these where you're like getting arguments with people and you're really brilliant? Sometimes they get physical. You make them look stupid so they take your embarrassment in your head. It all works out. I could have went down that path. I could have withdrew in embarrassment from my wife who did nothing wrong, but because she's close and I'm scared of intimacy in that moment, I back away from her. I could have played the victim and started just like lambasting them and going, why God, would you let this happen? And you know what all of those things would have done? Made it worse. It would have taken the negative feelings and just poured gasoline on them. It just would have made it worse. And if I did that, I think I definitely would have started sliding down that hill. But by the grace of God, I made a different decision. And in that moment, I engaged self-care by embracing and kind of repeating a little mantra. Yeah, I am God's beloved and he is mine. That's just what I just kept saying to myself. I am God's beloved and he is mine. I am God's beloved and he is mine. I just kept saying it until I felt it. So what if those people forgot me? No, it does not feel good when we're forgotten, even when it's accidental. However, God hasn't forgotten me. He saw me there, my coat, my tie. He saw how excited I was. He knew. It made me think of my girls. One of my favorite things to do with my daughters is just to surprise them, grab them, and pull them up and say, I got you. You're mine. You belong to me. I say it like in a villainy voice, but I mean it like a loving father. But my hope is that over time, that message sinks into their little hearts, that there is always someone that wants them. I hope that sinks into their hearts, that there's always someone that wants them. I'm not always going to be perfect at communicating that love to them, and it's likely I will fail them, but hopefully that seed is planted and it will find its fruition not in me but in God, who will never fail them in communicating that message. And that message applies to me. He hasn't forgotten me. He always wants me. And that applies to you. You matter deeply to our Creator. So instead of dealing with the feelings of disrespect by entering into an anger fantasy where I get even with all these jokers or numbing the pain with food or with surfing the internet, I made a good choice. I chose self-care. I took comfort in that beautiful truth. I am God's beloved, and he is mine. It's amazing how just little spiritual mantras can help us get out of the funk. Why don't you stand with me? This is my challenge to you this year, is to actually do some work in this area. It's an encouragement. I'm not going to like command you, thus saith the Lord. But you know, I grew up, and you know, legalism uses a lot of shoulds, right? And shoulds are communicated with guilt and shame and oughts. You know, like I've learned to say to when I feel that, I say to my stay in my head, stop shooting on me. You know, I've learned to say that, and it works. So I'm not going to should on you. But I am going to say, I believe Jesus, what he said, matters. I believe that a life that follows the rhythms of grace that could be described as free and light is possible for all of us. That's what following him means, trusting that he knows that path and can take us where our Creator has always intended us to go. And so the work, I would tell you, is to sit down. Each of you are going to have different answers, but what are the things you can do to truly fill your tanks? You may even put them in three columns. What fills my body tank? What fills my being tank? What fills my connections tank? And even think through, like, what do I need to soothe myself? I encourage meditation, just quiet prayer and reflection, or journaling. Those things are really, really good to just kind of get out of the angst. And then find a mantra if you can, like just a pithy spiritual truth that really speaks to your heart. My wife, hers is, all my hope is in you. That's what she says. And she'll repeat it until she believes it. And so my encouragement to you this the beginning of this year is to start this year in a place of strength, being armed with the knowledge that taking care of yourself is not selfish. It's a holy responsibility. May this be a year where you take one or two large strides towards living lightly, towards living freely, learning the rhythms of grace. That is, as we love ourselves, we will find greater and greater strength to love others. So now to him who is able to keep you from falling, to present you before his glorious presence without fault and with great joy. To the only God, our Savior, be glory, power, majesty, and authority through Jesus Christ our Lord, now and forevermore, throughout all the ages. And we all say, amen. Blessings, guys.